You know, there are many, many brands that go out and you get some eager entrepreneurs go out, think franchising is going to be the easy way to grow. But boy, if you make the wrong choices in the earliest stages, you can kill the whole thing before it gets off the launch pad. Even when you achieve a national brand status, the brand, of course, doesn't always perform the same way everywhere. You're going to have a highest performing restaurant, you're always going to have a lowest performing restaurant. So whether you're talking nationally, I know that's just common sense. The key to a successful franchise is, or a successful brand is the worst good enough? As long as the worst is good enough, you've got a massively successful enterprise.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of Tech Bites. Today, we have a special guest. I've had the pleasure of connecting with him and sort of knowing him throughout the last decade and a half, and he's an incredible story in the restaurant space. He has joined a brand when it only had 65 locations and grew that brand all the way to 1,200 locations. You don't really see people able to adopt and continue level setting all the way up to 1,200 units because you're going from a small brand to enterprise. That guest today is Don Fox. He's an incredible human being, and there's an incredible story how I connected with him back in the day. But Don, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Hamid.
So first question I want to ask is on the background. So let's tell us what's in the background.
Okay. Yeah, as I was, said a little bit earlier before we came on air, you probably don't see a Thompson submachine gun too many times when you're doing a podcast. It is a replica. It's not the real thing. But that is there in connection with my interest in World War II history. So I've written 3 books up to this point and have a 4th underway. So in addition to my restaurant career, that is a long-standing passion of mine and looking forward to devoting even more time to it in the years ahead.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, definitely don't see any podcast with that in the background, but it caught my attention the moment you joined on. I'm like, oh, that's a great topic. All right, so as I was introducing you, it's really difficult to get into a restaurant that has 65 units and then grow it to 1,200 units. The business completely changes, and you don't see a lot of people being able to adapt to that change. So give us a little bit of a history. Why did you join Firehouse and how did you manage that?
Well, sure. I joined Firehouse back in 2003, and that followed a 23-year career with Burger King Corporation. I joined Burger King all the way back in 1980. I was young, 22 years old, started pretty close to the ground level, an assistant manager, worked my way up through a pretty traditional career path. Assistant manager, restaurant manager, district manager. Had 6 excellent years at Burger King headquarters from 89 to 95. I was in research and development, an operations role. That was a fantastic learning experience. And then went back out into field operations. That's how I got to Jacksonville, Florida. I was a field rep at any given time, covered as far south as West Palm Beach, all the way up to the Charleston market. And in 2003, shortly after the sale of Burger King at the time to Bain Capital, I was let go from Burger King. It wasn't something I expected at the time. Again, I'd already had 23 years under my belt. I guess you could say I was a lifer, no plans to leave, but fate stepped in a different way. And that is what led to Firehouse. So my family loved living in Jacksonville. I had other opportunities. We could have moved, but family didn't want to. It was very important to them to stay. So looking for opportunities here, I discovered the Firehouse Subs brand. I wasn't that familiar with it as a customer. It wasn't in the competitive space at the time with Burger King, you know, or traditional QSRs. You know, back then, well, especially when Firehouse was founded in 1994, people didn't talk about a fast casual segment, which is later where Firehouse got placed. And even in 2003, when I joined, I would say that term wasn't in vogue. But Firehouse was one of few opportunities that were here, certainly the only brand meaningful brand, I would say, that was headquartered here. So I met the founders, Robin Sorensen and Chris Sorensen. We hit it off. It was very good timing, a little bit of karma. They had actually been looking for someone perhaps a year earlier to help them with the franchise side of their business. You know, the founders, they had a couple of partners. One, a gentleman by the name of Kelly Harris, had a lot of years with a chain called Quincy's Steakhouse. And within that brand, he didn't have any experience working with franchisees. So that's what I brought to the table, many years of history working within the Burger King franchise system. But it was small. Here I go from the second largest restaurant company in the world at the time, behind, obviously, McDonald's, to a 65-unit brand under 50 million in sales, the best I recall. Average unit volume maybe was about 550,000 a year at that point. And boy, talk about one end of the spectrum to the other. So before I made the final decision, the first thing I did was experience the brand. And that very first time going into a Firehouse Subs restaurant, ironically, not very far from my home in Jacksonville, only about a mile away, not if that, but I hadn't been a customer. My brand awareness was very low. But boy, did I have a great experience. The food was fantastic. It totally differentiated from a typical sub shop. And that, in combination with the Sorensen's personality, their entrepreneurial drive, I mean, they were clearly very motivated to take this young brand, 9 years old at the time, and try to grow it into something big. So long backstory, but a lot of different pieces coming together put me in the right place at the right time.
All great things happens because you get fired.
Correct. It was in retrospect, it was the best thing that could have ever happened.
100% I agree, because I got fired out of Best Buy and that was my last position, and I became an entrepreneur by accident. So, but I remember I was crying in the parking lot when I got fired, and yeah, amazing. All right, let's. So when I think of like firemen, I think they're chefs, because they're spending a week on the job, or they're there, they're cooking, they're doing all this stuff. So I think that actually shows in the brand too, with the giant subs that they make and they stack it all the way and et cetera. So
definitely, so, it's very, very much a part of the culture of the firehouse, and that was embedded right from the start.
Perfect. So that leads us, that great, thanks for the backstory, and that actually brings us to our first topic, franchising, challenges and successes of franchising. So how did you guys maintain consistency, quality across the entire brand? As you're growing, things change, but how did you manage that?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of key elements. One was the nature of the franchising system, the architecture of it itself. So even prior to my arriving at Firehouse, the Sorensens had decided on an area representative model to scale it. When they sold their first franchises, they didn't have that in place. In fact, their first franchises were in 1995, and they learned a lot of lessons from that. Those were, by and large, mistakes. They had one company restaurant that they operated, and they were approached by local people with an interest in doing it, and they got all excited with the idea that, oh, people want to invest in this, open up franchises. So they ran out, it was a uniform franchise offering circular at the time, is what it was called, FDD today. And they went out and they sold these franchise deals, and the operators may have been well-intentioned, but it just wasn't the best choice of operators. And they survived it. Here's a key thing. You know, there are many, many brands that go out and maybe with entrepreneurial, everybody starts with one unit. You get some eager entrepreneurs go out, think franchising is going to be the easy way to grow. But boy, if you make the wrong choices in the earliest stages, you can kill the whole thing before it gets off the launch pad. So there were some mistakes made. But fortunately, because of some good frugality, harboring their resources, they were able to work their way through that and then eventually got it on track about 4 or 5 years later to relaunch franchising and with the area representative model. So There's a lot of brands that use it. Subway famously, built, they I think call it area developer. There were some differences, and I certainly influenced this when I got there in 2003 because I got there about a year and a half after they started the area rep model. So the form of agreement was in place, but there was still a lot of muscle that had to be put on around the bones to make it work effectively.
Actually, tell me, what is this area thing?
So with the area, it's basically a two-tier franchising model. So the area representative is the higher level, and they acquire the rights to provide support and service on behalf of the franchisor. Now, in our system, they had to also own and operate a restaurant in their territory, what we would call a training restaurant. So they were very local, and again, a point of differentiation that we had versus at least some other brands is that we limited the scale. So it was my belief that an individual area representative could perhaps handle a territory up to about 50 restaurants if they selected wisely and didn't end up with a slew of single unit operators. They should probably aim for 3 to 5 restaurants per franchisee. You know, ideally, perhaps up to 15 franchisees were the number of relationships that I felt they could manage effectively. And if the territory was going to be larger, let's say a very large DMA, like a Dallas, Los Angeles, well, then we would need either more than one area rep or a partnership, and that would be the better solution, is to have perhaps a partnership of two. In fact, in one instance, we had a partnership of 5 area representatives that had Atlanta, large portions of the Western Carolinas, Eastern Tennessee, but all partners who are active in the business that can they are all capable of managing those relationships with franchisees. So then they can scale up that 5 person area rep business. Their total build out for their territory was going to be 250 to 300 restaurants. So those people, those area representatives, were critical. They had skin in the game, highly motivated, very motivated to sell franchises, because they don't start to really realize their income until there's a royalty stream coming in. Because at least, and again, this varies by brands, but in the Firehouse subs system, the royalty was split initially 50-50 between the franchisor and the area representative. Franchisee was paying 6%, royalty 3-3 split. That is a very lucrative deal, by the way, for the area representative. Think about it. Back then, when I first came on board, let's just round it up a little bit, 600,000 in average unit volume. So every restaurant is generating for that area representative $18,000 a year. And in their role, while they wore a lot of hats, I don't want to oversimplify their role, but the closest equivalent would be working as a franchise field consultant in a corporate organization where you're working directly with franchisees. One of my roles at Burger King was as we called it a franchise business manager back then. And my territory at one point was as high as, I think, about 120 restaurants in the territory. Different times in the history of Burger King. I remember way back in the early 90s, my territory in that role was 30 restaurants. So it really, really varied quite a bit over the years. But think about the numbers for a moment. So for a field rep, area representative in the Firehouse world, even if they only had 10 restaurants in their territory doing that 600,000 average unit volume, they were generating $180,000 of income for providing support and service for 10 restaurants. Now, obviously, with the charge of building out more units, but for the work being done, it was way above what a commensurate salary would be for someone doing relatively the same role. So we had extremely talented, motivated people. And one thing I would say about, again, that model, and this leads to the motivation, while it's highly compensated as they build it out, they start with nothing. They've yeah. paid the franchisor a fee for the rights to do this. They've had to invest, build out their own training restaurant in the territory. So they've got some pretty serious skin in the game. And at first, other than the income they're deriving from that training restaurant, there's no cash flow coming in. It's all them predicated on their hard work and effort. So we've become great partners in this, and people that built great businesses. So as they're in doing that, they're invested, skin in the game. They know that franchisee selection is going to be critical for their success.
Which actually, that touches base on the next question. So what criteria did you guys have for picking out franchisees? How did you pick out who's qualified, who's not qualified, who's capable, not capable?
Well, one of the very interesting things about my many years with Firehouse is looking at the diversity, the broad array of people coming in. Having restaurant experience was almost always a big plus. You speak the same language when we're in initial conversations. You can relate to that person a lot better. You can tease out of them things about their knowledge of the business that kind of separates whether they're good or not. Perhaps if they're operating existing restaurants, you can go look at their business and see how they're doing. If they're not adhering to basic tenets of quality service and cleanliness in an existing restaurant operation, well, what makes you think they're going to do any different when they start operating a Firehouse Subs? But I've never ran the numbers on it, but I wouldn't be surprised if as much as half of the franchise community came to us without restaurant experience. So certainly it wasn't a prerequisite. And some of the very best franchisees we had in our system didn't have any restaurant background. We had a great ability to train them up because, and I'll go back to the area reps on this, because the area rep was working with them side by side in the territory. We were involved at the corporate franchisor level as well. We had training classes that we ran initially a two-week course. We later downsized that to 1 week several years after I got there. But we really did a great job of coaching people up and putting them in a position to succeed. As long as they had, generally, as long as they had some good starting business acumen and a desire to embrace the brand and what our mission was, we knew we could provide all the coaching necessary to help them succeed.
Got you. So let's kind of go backwards. Let's go back to the beginning. 65 locations, you're in the job for a year. What would you do differently? Let's clarify, like, what are the two or three things that you would do differently? And then I want to come back to what are the two or three things that you would absolutely repeat all over again?
Yeah, you know, it's when we had the degree of success that we did, you know, getting to over 1,000 restaurants, reaching $1 billion in system sales, and doing it on, compared to, let's say, the industry, general history of the industry, doing it on a pretty solid timetable. Mm-hmm. It's hard to look back pick out too many things that we did wrong, per se.
But couldn't have been just straight to the right and just overnight success.
But we could have always done things better. And one thing that if I were to do it over again, I would maybe have been even more discerning on the selection of franchisees and in some cases area representatives. I think we were better than most at that. And in fact, up until within the last year of the brand, I was involved in interviewing every franchisee. I up till the very end, presented to every franchise candidate in a day of discovery. So I really felt it was critical to have that personal interaction, and just they knew from me directly what the expectations were if they joined this brand. Because, by the way, if they didn't meet those expectations, they failed to perform in a meaningful way that was going to lead to potentially a default on their franchise agreement, I knew that was going to involve me. I was, in the end, I'd be the person making the most critical decision, which was relative to either default or, at the worst case, termination. And if I did that, I had to be confident that they knew what was expected. And I knew they knew, because I knew I was the one who told them. But having said all that, when I look back on it and I see some of the mistakes or the situations that didn't work out with franchisees, there were times that we should have said no. And again, I would say, if I'm brutally honest about it, when those failures happened, it didn't necessarily come as a total surprise, because it was perhaps with a little bit of doubt or a little bit of reservation that we might have made an approval. You know, keeping in mind that, especially when we had the area representative system, they're trying to build their business. We know they're going to be managing the relationship. And if they felt confident enough to send the person to us for approval and for a discovery day, well, in the end, they, perhaps more than anyone else, were going to be the person having to live with that decision. So if we were sitting on the fence with a candidate, we would tilt the way of letting it go forward because the area representative had the confidence to send the person on. So looking back on it, though, I said, you know, maybe we shouldn't have tilted that way all the time and pulled the plug on some folks.
And that's a difficult decision because you're trying to grow the brand, you're trying to, you know, build revenue and et cetera. However, yeah, sometimes it's better to go slow to go fast.
And I will say that, you know, the key to being able to say no, and the Sorensen brothers get 100% of the credit for this. They were extraordinarily frugal, kept all the money in the business. By the time I joined in 2003, they had no debt. And I think they had paid off their last loans a year and a half before I got there. And not having that pressure of owing someone anything, they had some very early investors. There was no pressure from the investor side to produce results at any, you know, given point in time. So they were able to always do what they viewed as being the right thing and never for short-term need to pay a bill. Hand in hand with that, they were also very wise to have a core foundation of company restaurants. Now one thing that I wouldn't call it a mistake, but if I had it to do over again, I think I would have pushed harder to try to get more company restaurants, because they were a great investment. And through your company portfolio, especially in the earlier days of growing the brand, yeah, that's where you're going to cultivate people. So when I joined Firehouse, of course, I came from the outside, and so too did almost every executive that came in. Understandably, I mean, you can't strictly grow people out of the restaurants. You're not going to get all the skill sets that you need there, especially when you start to talk about disciplines like finance and research and development and purchasing and so on. Those people have to almost always come from the outside. But the broader you make that base of company operations, the more upward potential you have for people to advance, the deeper well you have to draw operational people for supporting the franchise system, which fast forward many years, you know, that eventually came to roost, you know, needing those internal folks. We had area representatives started to leave the system well before Restaurant Brands International purchased Firehouse. Now there are no longer area representatives in the system. But some of those first exits started to happen about 4 to 5 years prior to RBI purchasing the brand, and then about a year and a half before it was really accelerating. And every one of those slots, those positions that the area rep held, we needed to build a team suddenly to come in and provide support and service. And not just in the operations arena, because the area rep did more than just day-to-day ops. We needed more marketing people, real estate support. But first and foremost, those operational boots on the ground. And when you've got a good deep bench built up around more company restaurants, you've got more resources to draw from. Not to mention the fact that they were just great investments. Our company restaurants, and this was a point of differentiation with Firehouse, we were excellent at running our own restaurants. And that's not always the case with a lot of brands. And I've always felt confident based on our demonstrated skill that we could have gone on and developed perhaps multiple markets. You know, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, you have brands like Chipotle, Starbucks domestically, that have built just impressive
ginormous
brands,
yeah.
But billion, multi-billion dollar brands, all on company restaurants. And you know, in the case of Chipotle, it's I think they began in 1984. So in the history of, you know, looking across their lifespan, you know, they got to a scale with all under an all company restaurant base that was pretty impressive. You know, McDonald's,
I think they had a very unfair, yeah, exactly. I was about to touch base on that. They had a very unfair advantage versus anyone else. And I don't think any other brand can replicate Chipotle because you can't substitute experience. Mm-hmm. And by McDonald's coming in and essentially giving them free rein to explore the entire supply chain, the entire operational model of McDonald's, and they literally replicated that. And when they separated, they kept that intellectual property. Yep. And I think that is an unfair advantage that no other brand can tap into, and no one else is willing to share that with you. That's their trade secret.
No, I agree 100%. You know, McDonald's was the catalyst for that. And I wouldn't call it, though, I wouldn't go so far as to call it unfair, because people who would study the business models and look at it, that is one to study and learn from. Now, being able to find a partner, because there were other brands too, Restaurant Brands International, you know, for example, certainly has depth and experience. I could go down the list. You know, we could probably make a list of at least 10 or 12, how should I call it, umbrella companies, let's call it, mm-hmm. that could go in, and if they had the desire, if they were building into their business plan, could take an aspiring brand and replicate what was done with Chipotle. McDonald's doesn't have exclusivity on a brain trust to be able to do that. The capacity is there, I think, for that aspiring entrepreneur who's building the brand. Finding that partner to do it is a challenge. I don't know the history well enough on Chipotle to know how Steve Ells got connected there, but kudos to him. Yeah. For it, for getting it done.
Right time, right place, right product, all that helps. All right, I'm going to push back a little bit more. So I really want to get to like three of the positive negatives. So definitely the positive is go with the area directors or pick better franchisees. On the opposite side, the mistakes, don't pick the wrong franchisee. So I think we've got, that's a great yes and no.
Yeah.
What's the number two? Number two, positive thing that would definitely be repeated, and then what's the number two mistake that, yeah, don't do it again?
Yeah, certainly, you know, on the things that really worked well, the frugality piece, again, this was something inherited from the Sorensons, but that financial discipline was just fundamental for our success. So I would certainly do it the same way over again. Another element that, again, I would do the same way, is what we did philanthropically. I mean, the creation of the Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation in 2005 factored very into the history very early, just 2 years after my arrival. You know, that became the heart and soul of the brand, and I'm delighted that Restaurant Brands International has continued that tradition. You know, I still serve on the board of the foundation, as does Robin Sorensen, one of the co-founders. So very emotionally attached to sure. that cause, and yeah, big part of the brand. You know, going back again to the things that we would you know, could do differently. Again, it's a bit of a tough one for me to answer, because we didn't have any real significant setbacks, you know, along the way. Mirroring my response on the sometimes where we made a mistake on people selection, sometimes on real estate as well. I mean, John Namey was our vice president of real estate. In fact, John joined right about a year and a half after I joined, and he had come from a commercial real estate background, and I coached him up a bit in the early days to get him familiar with the restaurant space, more the operator side of it. But he did a magnificent job over the years, following some basic mission orders that I gave him. But still, there were some hard lessons learned, and maybe that they just had to be made so that we could benefit from them. But some selections early on with sites in towns that were just too small, or sometimes that there's no perfect site out there. Real estate sometimes is as much of an art as a science. But we probably pushed a bridge too far on some approvals along the line. I think also a big picture, this is something that I think all brands deal with, is even when you achieve a national brand status, the brand, of course, doesn't always perform the same way everywhere. A philosophy of mine, or something that I've espoused and told my team many times, is look, in all things, there's a best and a worst. You're going to have a highest performing restaurant, you're always going to have a lowest performing restaurant. So whether you're talking nationally, I know that's just common sense, but the key to a successful franchise is, or a successful brand is the worst good enough? As long as the worst is good enough, you've got a massively successful enterprise. And there were times, combination of maybe we just quite didn't get the operator right, we just didn't get the site right, and sometimes maybe we didn't recognize unique things about a market. And we did learn more and more about this as we went. You know, in the early days of a brand, and for people listening, and you know, in the early stages, you know, you don't have the benefit yet of the data to really be able to discern how your brand may operate, or you know, may perform, better said, in one part of the country or one region versus another. They're not homogenous. I would dare say, I'll go out on a limb and say there's not a single brand that has, you know, absolutely consistent results within a very narrow margin of performance across the entire country. And there's a whole host of factors that contribute to that. And I think we did a decent job of figuring that out over time, but if I had to do it over again, would have invested more in earlier years on harder or both qualitative and quantitative research to have better assessed the potential of some markets in different parts of the country.
Perfect. So let's get to the last question. I'm running Hamed's Burger Joint. How do I build a line around the corner, people begging me to give them a franchise?
Wow, that is the billion-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if anybody's qualified, it's going to be you. So yeah.
I think the key is you have to come up with the top two or three brand things, in my opinion, that really define your brand, that make it a success. I mean, you want to be perfect, you want to be great at everything, but that's virtually an impossible task. So, what are going to be those couple or three things that you are really going to hang your hat on? In two ways. First of all, to be able to execute against them, consistently deliver those two or three things, and then also it allows you to hone your focus on how you're going to promote the brand and stay really laser focused on those couple three things. You know, for Firehouse Subs, it was three things. We wrapped these up in the mission statement for the brand. One was hearty and flavorful food. I mean, the founders of Firehouse were incredible foodies. I mean, everything was their design. They designed all the sandwiches, came up with all the recipes, sourced all the ingredients. They get 100% of the credit for producing, for making, designing, if you will, that crafting is a better word, crafting that great food. And it became the team's mission to deliver on that. And over time, I spent more and more money on quantifying that. It's not enough, I don't think, that for the founder of any brand to sit there and think they've created the great. Obviously, when they create it, they think it's great, or you would presume, or they're not selling it. but does the public look at it that way? Are the guests that you're trying to reach, are they looking at it the same way? Is this something that you're really proud of, justifiably proud of, to sell? So for us, it started with the food, and then the other the second element was the service experience, you know, which we termed heartfelt service. And we needed to be known for that. The Sorensons, again, when they opened the very first restaurant, the way Robin Sorenson always described it was, he said, we're going to out-service everybody. They weren't worried about any competition on the hospitality front because they knew they could be friendlier. They knew they could be more welcoming. They knew that they were going to appreciate their guests more, because as a couple of young entrepreneurs starting up, they knew that their future rested on somebody making the elective decision to pull open the door and walk into that restaurant. Nobody had a gun to their head, like I do. So nobody was forcing them into that, and they deeply appreciated that, not just when they had the first restaurant, but for every restaurant going forward. And then the third element was our philanthropy, and we laid more and more into that when we realized there it was also of a benefit to the business. So for Hamed's Burgers, it's like what the question is, what are those couple, three things and that you're going to excel at and then promote and build awareness around?
Perfect. Yeah, that sounds. I mean, obviously, food has to be perfect. That's no given. I agree, because even every time I walk into Firehouse, you hear somebody yelling out, "Welcome to Firehouse!" Right? So
yeah, and which, by given. The way, it's a story worth talking about, because with Welcome to Firehouse, you know, that is just something that the founders did naturally, and it was never meant to be a shtick.
Thing.
You know, or a marketing brand or anything else. It was because of this underlying philosophy that we really appreciated every single guest who came in, because without them, they were nothing. And we would coach our team members, and which, by the way, one of the, you'll probably get to this in a little bit, but one of the biggest challenges achieving scale and looking at my role as CEO is in maintaining these cultural elements and then embedding it all the way down to the line level where it has to exist. You know, if going, heartfelt service is a great example. That part of our mission statement. And in fact, I'll back up a little bit. Hearty and flavorful food, well, we control the recipes, we source the ingredients, you know, we train people to make the sandwiches right. That, in the greater scheme of things, that's relatively easy. Delivering a heartfelt service consistently. And the heartfelt part is the critical part. That means the crew person really wants to deliver that, wants to be friendly, that they really appreciate the guests walking in. And I'm going to say that we get it right 100% of the time with every crew member. It becomes more and more difficult the larger you get. But you can never give up on that passion for doing it. If it's only your people at headquarters that are remembering it and reciting it back to you, that doesn't get you anywhere.
Yeah,
if it's not touching the customer, it's having zero impact. And kudos to a brand that does this perhaps better than anybody else, and that's Chick-fil-A.
Chick-fil-A, yeah, that's obviously it's always a pleasure there.
So, right, you yeah, cannot and, say if yeah. you're like me. If anytime someone says to me "my pleasure," I can't help but think about Chick-fil-A, and I would say I'm probably not alone in that. So it's unbelievable what it's done to their brand, but it's because of a deeply rooted cultural element that they have never let waver. I'm very proud of the fact. I consider Firehouse to be right in. Of that caliber. Over the years, I relied very heavily on the company Technomic and their consumer data, consumer brand metrics, very robust information. And I was able to benchmark against 160 other brands. And there were times when we would rank higher than Chick-fil-A on service. And when we did, that was a very proud day, because I always considered them, at least within the QSR space, as the gold standard. So I'll take that opportunity to say, again, advice for people listening in. All these things that we talk about, while they may seem soft, and we're talking about hearty and flavorful food, heartfelt service, commitment to public safety, you know, those are our three things. All of those things can be measured. if you have these what I'll call aspirational soft items that you're trying to excel at, they all can be measured. If they can't, you have a problem. Or if you're choosing not to measure them, you're going to have a problem. So big emphasis on that. And I think we probably performed much better than most brands at doing that.
Perfect. Well, that's it for this episode. We're going to touch base on technology on the future episode because we want to dive into that, especially starting a brand where technology didn't really exist at the early stages and as it changed, how you guys adopted with those changes. But thanks for everyone for tuning in, and don't forget to listen to the next episode that will be coming out next week, and that will cover all technology, and we'll have Don back on the future episodes. Thank you, Don.
Thanks, Ahmed.